In a world of need, people were constantly coming to Jesus. When we read through the Gospels, that's what's happening. All the time there seems to be a crowd of people around Jesus, or coming to Jesus, or searching for Jesus. He hardly has a moment's peace, because people are burdened. They're bowed down with sorrows and griefs and sicknesses and diseases and handicaps. And for many of them, a sense of uncertainty, a sense of unworthiness, a sense of sinfulness to differing degrees. They come to Jesus and they're crying out for help. Perhaps some of them are crying out verbally for help. Others have this yearning in their hearts that Jesus would speak a word that would be relevant for them, real to them, that would meet them at their point of need. And so they come day after day. They're there. They're following Jesus around from town to town, from village to village. For many, it's their own physical healing that they are seeking. Like the man that Luke talks about later on in his gospel. When Jesus drew near to Jericho, he says, a blind man was sitting by the roadside begging, and hearing a crowd going by, he inquired what this meant, and they told him, Jesus of Nazareth is passing by. And he cried out, Jesus, Son of David, have mercy on me. And those who were in front rebuked him, telling him to be quiet. But he cried all the more, Son of David, have mercy on me. Jesus stopped and commanded him to be brought to him. And when he came, he asked him, what do you want me to do for you? He said, Lord, let me recover my sight. He was a man in need. He was blind. He couldn't see. He couldn't work. So he sat there on the street begging. Others came for healing. For others, their friends or their family members. We already saw earlier in this gospel in chapter 5, the paralyzed man who was brought by his four friends upon a stretcher, and they were so eager that this friend of theirs should be healed of his paralysis that they went up onto the roof and they dug through the tiles and they lowered their friend down before Jesus, and how happy they were to hear him say, take up your bed and walk. Still others were seeking justice. There were two brothers and they were arguing together about the inheritance. And Luke tells us in chapter 12 and in verse 13 that they came to Jesus, and one of the brothers said to him, Teacher, tell my brother to divide the inheritance with me. This is what they wanted. They wanted justice. And they came to Jesus as a great teacher, and they're looking for justice. They come to the one who speaks with authority, and he is a brother, and he's thinking, well, Jesus says the word. My brother will have to listen. And still others come to Jesus, and all they want is for peace in their souls. All they want is to know that their sins are forgiven. And there came one woman, Luke tells us in chapter 7, in verse 36, and she came and she knelt at his feet. She wept tears upon his feet and washed them and wiped them with her hair. Why? Because she was a sinner. And here was a saviour. She was marred by her iniquity. And here was one who could cleanse her and wash her. She has been forgiven much, Jesus says. And here, in these opening verses of chapter 7 of Luke's Gospel, here's another example of one who sought Jesus. He sought him because he believed that Jesus could help him. And Luke's purpose is including this story in his account of the life of Jesus is because it's illustrative of the way that faith works to accomplish the purposes of God in the lives of sinners. It's illustrative for us in the physical dimension of what Jesus came to do for us spiritually. As he brings healing to the body, it is illustrative of the fact that he can bring healing to the soul. And this is flowing out then of what Luke has recorded for us of Jesus' sermon on the plain. You remember how he pronounced a blessing upon people. Such a strange blessing it was. Blessed are the poor, the hungry, the weeping, and the persecuted. And he pronounced woes, and what strange woes they were. Woe to the rich, the full, the happy, and those who are spoken well of. He turned the world upside down for those who were listening to him. He called upon them to love their enemies, to love those who persecuted them, to bless those who cursed them, to do good to those who abused them. He called upon them to have a lower estimate of themselves than of the people around them. He called upon them to trust him, to trust his word, and to build their lives upon the foundation of his teaching. And out of that teaching then comes this illustration of someone who believed Jesus, of someone who trusted in Jesus. Now, I'm not suggesting that Chapter 7 and verses 1 through 10 is giving us a picture or an actual example of saving faith. I'm not convinced that that's the case in this particular instance. It is an illustration of faith that brought healing to this man's servant. But I'm not convinced that it's saving faith that brought healing to this man's soul, though maybe as a result of Jesus' work on this particular occasion, this man continued to have an interest in Jesus that resulted eventually in saving faith. But this story does illustrate saving faith. It provides us for a picture of saving faith and some things that we need to know about faith. And there are three things that I want to talk about with regard to faith from this account of the healing of the centurion's servant. I want to talk about the prerequisite to faith, first of all. I want to talk about the object of faith and the exercise of faith. So firstly, the prerequisite to faith. This man, this centurion, he had heard about Jesus, and he sent people to Jesus because his servant was sick and at the point of death. He was a valuable servant. I think that when he talks about him being a valuable servant, he's not thinking in terms of monetary value, though we could translate it the fact that he was a slave rather than simply a servant. It's not the fact that he's about to lose an asset. No, there's an affection for this man that is evident in the longing that this centurion has for his healing. And this centurion sends men to Jesus to ask him to come and heal his servant. And as these men come, they come to Jesus and they plead with him. And they represent the man in these terms. He is worthy to have you do this for him. Now, he's a centurion. He's almost certainly a Gentile. And this man, therefore, is outside of the normal sphere of Jesus' focus. Jesus came first and foremost to the Jews. On the odd occasion, he interacted with Gentiles, but most of the time it was to the Jews that he came. And this centurion then is perhaps uncertain. Will Jesus listen to me? Will Jesus take an interest in me? Will Jesus be concerned about what burdens my heart? I've heard about him. I've heard about the healing of the many people in Capernaum, in my hometown. I've heard too about the casting out of a demon-possessed man in the synagogue that I built. I've heard about this man, and I know that he has power, and I know that he is concerned for the well-being of people, but will he be concerned about me? And so he sends the Jews to him. He's got friends in high places among the Jews. He's obviously a centurion who is well respected by the Jews in the community. After all, he's built them a synagogue. That's a good thing if you're a Jew. And there are many centurions that are mentioned in the New Testament who are mentioned very positively. In fact, I think all but one mention of the centurion in the New Testament is a positive thing. We have the centurion that Peter went and preached the gospel to, who was a God-fearing man. In other words, he was one who had embraced Judaism. This man isn't described in those terms, though. He's not described as a one who fears God, but one who loves our nation and who built us our synagogue. Well, he sends these Jewish friends of his along to Jesus, perhaps because they're Jews, Jesus will listen to them. And in addition, they take it upon themselves to discuss the worthiness of this Gentile for Jesus to minister to him and serve him and bless him. He is worthy to have you do this for him. That was the way that the Jews thought. You had to live a life that was worthy of the blessing of God. That was particularly the way the Jewish leaders thought. This was the whole Pharisaical system, that you had to live a life that was worthy if God was going to bless you. And if you didn't live a life that was worthy, then you would come under his curse and his displeasure. So here they come, these Jewish elders, and they're saying, this man deserves to be helped by you, Jesus. He loves our nation. He built this synagogue. It's time for him to be paid out for his loyalty to us. The man himself has a different opinion, though. He thinks that he is unworthy. As Jesus approaches his home, he sends out another delegation. This time it's his friends who he sends out. He's obviously been thinking over, as he sent out the first delegation, and as Jesus has made the journey to his home, perhaps some minutes or even hours have passed, and he's been thinking about this request that he has sent, and he's thinking more and more about how unworthy he is to have this great teacher, this godly man, this powerful man, come into his own home and heal his servant. So he sends this second delegation. Lord, he says through them, do not trouble yourself, for I am not worthy to have you come under my roof. I'm not worthy. I don't deserve to have you come to me. I don't deserve to have you come into my home. I'm a sinner. I'm a Gentile. I'm not a God-fearer. There are so many things in my life that would discredit me and discount me from any favor from you. I'm not worthy for you to come. And yet Jesus comes. Jesus responds to the petition of the elders, and he comes. when they say that he's worthy that you do this for him. He comes, he doesn't argue with them. On some occasions he does argue with people. He does correct people. There was a young man who came to him once asking how he might have eternal life. And Jesus said to him, well, you keep the law. And he said, well, I have kept the law. From my youth I've kept the law. And then Jesus points out that he hasn't, because he's unwilling to give up his wealth. He's a covetous man. He's clinging to those riches. He's a lover of money more than a lover of God. He doesn't love God with all his heart, soul, mind and strength. He doesn't love his neighbour as himself. He's not willing to give up his wealth so that the poor can be helped. And Jesus corrects him. Jesus challenges him. But here he doesn't say to these Jewish leaders, oh, you know, no one is worthy. No one has a right to my favour. No one has a right to be blessed by me. I'm not duty bound just because this man loves Israel and has built a synagogue to go and bless him. No one is worthy. All have sinned and fallen short of the glory of God, Jesus could have said. But he doesn't. He goes. He goes along with them, trudges through the lanes of Capernaum until they reach the house of this man. And there's this group of other men who are coming. Jesus hears what they have to say. He doesn't say, oh well, at least he's acknowledging his unworthiness, I'll go now. No, he does what the man first asked for, and he heals his servant. Jesus helps. He helps not because this centurion is worthy. He helps because this centurion is needy. And he's recognized his need, and he's recognized that there is someone who can help him in his need. Furthermore, as we understand that this is illustrative of faith that saves, we need to recognize too that Jesus, in the case of the forgiveness of sins, is able to help because he is worthy. He's able to help because he is worthy. Jesus came into the world not to save sick servants from their sickness, or blind men from their blindness, or bitter brothers from their quarrels. Jesus came into this world to save sinners. He was born of the Virgin Mary in the stable in Bethlehem in order to save sinners. He grew up in Nazareth under the law, being completely obedient to all its demands from childhood through to adulthood in order to save sinners. Jesus Christ was fully submissive to the will of the Father in all things, and was obedient to the point of death on the cross to bear the wrath of God against sinners, because that was why he came, to save sinners. Ultimately, that must be the whole focus of Jesus' life. And anything else that happened in Jesus' life is illustrative and points towards this greatest transaction that he would perform of all that he did in his life. Jesus was worthy to save sinners. Jesus was worthy to stand in their place because he was perfect. The sinless one took upon the sins of his people and bore them on the cross and took the wrath of God that they deserved so that they may be at peace with God. He was worthy to do that because he was sinless. He didn't have to bear the wrath of God himself. He didn't have to come under the judgment of God himself. He had earned the favor of God. He had earned the right to be with God. And yet he surrendered himself to the cross so that he could save sinners. unworthy sinners, people who don't deserve and cannot demand a blessing from God, Jesus comes into their lives and he says, I'll take your place. I'll stand in your place in the dock. I will bear the judgment. I will take the condemnation. I will take the punishment. I will bear your iniquities in my own body upon the cross. I am worthy, Jesus says. No one else is worthy. And this sense of unworthiness is a prerequisite to faith. A right understanding of who we are is absolutely essential to faith. If we think for a moment that there is something in us that merits God's favor, if we think for a moment that there is any goodness within us, any rightness in us that God would respond to it and say, oh, well, you're someone I can bless. You're someone I can accept. You're someone I can receive. You need a little bit of cleaning up around the edges. Jesus will sort that out. But basically, you're a good person. You're welcome. Now, no one's like that. There is no one who is good. There is no one who is right. There is no one who truly seeks God. So God sent Jesus to seek and to save that which was lost. And we need to understand that about ourselves, that there is nothing good in us, nothing that would be worthy of a blessing from God. Jesus helps us not because we are worthy, he helps us because we are needy. And we need to believe that. We need to trust him on that basis and not any other. So the prerequisite to faith then is a sense of our own unworthiness. And the second thing that I want to talk about briefly is the object of our faith. Here in this centurion is a man who was well respected in the community. Even the Jews respected him. He loved their nation. He built them a synagogue. He was a man who had authority. There he was. He was commissioned by the Roman Empire to be a leader of men. And he could command them, go, and he goes, come, he comes, do this, and he does it. This is a man with authority. But his authority is limited. Here he is, he's got this servant in his home, whom he's grown to appreciate and to love and to respect and to have a deep concern about. Oh, this servant of his has been such a faithful servant. Always gone when he's been told to go. Always come when he's been told to come. Always done this when he's been told to do this. But now here's a man who's absolutely helpless. His servant is at the point of death and he cannot say to the disease that is riddling his body with paralysis and say to him, be gone! He won't go. He has not the authority to banish the sickness from his servant's body. But he's learned of someone who has that authority. He has learned of the man who can. And so he sends this delegation to Jesus. There's a man who can do it. There's a man who not only has authority over servants, not only has authority over his followers, this is a man who has authority over disease. He can banish sickness from a person's body and it goes in a moment, it's gone, there's cleansing. The leper is fully healed. The lame is able to walk. What power, what authority this man has. And so he sends these men to him. He sought help from one who was greater. Jesus said before he rose and ascended into heaven. He said, "All authority is given to me in heaven and on earth." And on the basis of that, he commissioned his disciples to go into all the world and make disciples of all nations. All authority was his. And this man recognized that. He saw in Jesus a man who had power and authority over sickness. Here was someone who could help him. And here then was the object of his faith. Jesus of Nazareth, the man who can. And he must be the object of our faith. He is the only one who can save. "There is no other name under heaven given among men," Peter said, "by which we must be saved." There is no one else who is able to do it. There is no one else who is able to take our sin, take my sin, take it from me, and bear its judgment himself. Because every other person in the world is just like me, under condemnation and judgment. Every other person in the world is under the wrath and condemnation of God. No one else then can pay the price. But Jesus can, because he was sinless. He was perfect. Not only that, not only was he sinless, not only was he perfect, not only was he free from sin, but he was willing. He was willing to come into this world and to bear my sins in his body upon the cross. He was willing, the sinless one, to take on sin himself. It is an incredible thought that God the Son should be willing to come into this world, knowing that it would mean separation from God, the wrath of God being poured out upon him, not for anything that he had done to bring God's displeasure on him. A purely voluntary substitution of himself in the place of others. And he must be the object of our faith then. He is the only one who can save us. He is the only one who has the right to take our place. People look in all sorts of places for ways to get right with God. They look at doing all sorts of different things. They think, well, if we make the right kind of sacrifice, either a literal sacrifice of an animal or something, or some great personal sacrifice. Maybe if I go on a particular pilgrimage or do a particular good deed, then God will be happy with me. God will forget about those bad things that I've done. But none of us can do good. No, not one. None of us can satisfy God in his righteousness except Jesus. He is the man who can. And he then must be the object of our faith. And then, in the third place, faith must be exercised. Mustn't it? It must be exercised. Faith, an entrusting of ourselves to Jesus. This is what this man did. And he's commended for his faith. Jesus says, "I tell you, not even in Israel have I found such faith." Not even among the Jews have I found faith like this. What is Jesus saying? Is Jesus saying something like, well, you know, this man, he's a Gentile, but he has such great faith, I'm going to act upon it, and I'm going to work for this man. I'm going to bless him for his great faith. Well, no, that's not what Jesus is saying. What Jesus is explaining is that this man, despite not having the rich heritage that Israel has, nevertheless put his trust in Jesus' ability to bless him. Israel should have had faith. Israel should have been trusting in Jesus. They had every benefit in the world over and above any other people upon this planet. God had revealed himself to Israel over and over and over again. He had constituted them as a nation with laws that he had given to them. He had revealed to them at Mount Sinai. They weren't like the other nations who were, as Paul says in Acts 17, groping in the darkness, trying somehow to reach God. Well, these people had everything that they needed to reach God. They had all the instructions on how they should reach God. They had all of the laws that would guide them to an understanding of their sinfulness. They had a sacrificial system that pointed them to the need for a substitute and a representative. They had all the prophets and all the teachings pointing to the fact that one was to come who would meet all of their needs. And yet when the one came, his own people didn't recognize him. The Jews should have responded to his teaching, recognizing it to be the truth, so perfectly consistent with all of the revelation of God that had gone before, and yet they seemed to be blind to it all. And Jesus commends this centurion for his faith, because while the Jews should have had faith considering their heritage, this Gentile, with a much more limited knowledge that basically consists of the fact that he has seen the amazing things that Jesus has done in the lives of other people and has heard about his amazing teaching, and he has a sense that this Jesus can help him. And he trusts in that. And he sends this delegation to Jesus and he says, I'm not worthy for you to come, but I know that you can bless me. Will you please bless me? He exercises faith. He acts upon the knowledge that he has. This man's understanding of God and his word was much more limited than the Jews, but he acted on what he had heard and seen and understood, whereas the Jews didn't. They were consistently rejecting the teachings that they were hearing, the signs that they were observing. Jesus himself on one occasion says to them, look, if you won't believe my word, believe me at least for the signs that I'm doing. But they just kept on asking for more and more and more signs. However many signs he performed, it was one too few, because they didn't have faith. They weren't acting upon the knowledge that they have had, and they weren't trusting in Jesus. They weren't laying hold of him. This man had a faith that Jesus hadn't seen in Israel, because with such limited knowledge of him, he nevertheless was willing to trust him. The Sermon on the Plain that we've been looking at in these past few weeks has called us to trust Christ and his word, to build our lives upon him, even when it seems contrary to our own rational way of thinking. We saw that, didn't we? Over and over again, the Sermon on the Plain challenged people's normal view of life. Normal view of priorities, normal view of the way to react in different situations. He turned everything on its head, and Jesus says, trust me. Trust me. Build your life on this teaching that is so contrary to everything that you have heard before, and you will be blessed. That's what the Sermon on the Plain is calling us to build our lives upon him, and not to trust in our own understanding. And this story calls us then to exercise faith in Christ, and to do so not because we are worthy of a blessing from him, but because we have recognized that we need a blessing from him. And without his help, we are done for. We need to be like that sinner who stood in the corner of the temple with his head bowed, and he cried out, "God, be merciful to me, a sinner." What's your sense of your own worth? Does God owe you something? What's the object of your faith? You can do it? Really? Are you acting upon what you know about Jesus? Or are you rejecting it and going your own way? There is only one way to God, and that is through Jesus Christ. Hear him. Live by his word. Trust in him to fulfill his promises.